No, son, Boston. On the sea. We have relations there. Father and son put on coats and gloves. They lock the shop and step out into the muted streets of the little snowbound village on Lake Michigan. As they walk through the snow, villagers pass. Some of the greetings are quick and cold with averted faces. Is it all right if my friends come to dinner, father? They'll be bringing fish and bread. All right with me, son. But they aren't well seen here, there's talk in the village, son. Bad talk about all of you. If it wasn't for Bert Hansen's father being a shipowner and one of the richest men in town, there'd be more than talk. Quicker we move the better. Could the others come too? Well, son, I could use some more hands in the shop. No limit to how many guns we can sell in a seaport like Boston, and I'm thinking maybe Mr. Hansen would pay to get his son out of here. Spring morning, doves call from the woods. Noah Blake and his father, Bert Hansen, Clinch Todd, Paco, and Sean Brady board a boat with their luggage stacked on deck. The villagers watch from the pier. Mrs. Norton sniffs and says in her penetrating voice, "Good riddance to the lot of them." She glances sideways at her husband. "I share the same views," he says hastily. Boston, 2 years later. Mr. Blake has prospered. He works now on contracts from shipowners, and his guns are standard issue. He has remarried. His wife is a quiet, refined girl from New York. Her family are well-to-do importers and merchants with political connections. Mr. Blake plans to open a New York branch, and there is talk of Army and Navy contracts. Noah Blake is studying navigation. He wants to be a ship's captain, and all five of the boys want to ship out. "Wait till you find the right ship," Mr. Blake tells them. One winter day, Noah is walking on the waterfront with Bert, Clinch, Sean and Paco. They notice a ship called the Great White. Rather small but very clean and trim. A man leans over the rail. He has a beefy red smiling face and cold blue eyes. "You boys looking for a ship?" "Maybe," says Noah cautiously. "Well, come aboard." He meets them at the gangplank. "I'm Mr. Thomas, first mate." He extends a hand like call-used beef and shakes hands with each boy in turn. He leads the way to the master's cabin. "This is Captain Jones, master of the Great White. These boys are looking for a ship, maybe." The boys nod politely. Captain Jones looks at them in silence. He is a man of indeterminate age with a gray-green pallor. He speaks at length, in a flat voice, his lips barely moving. "Well, I could use five deck hands. You boys had any experience?" "Yes. On the Great Lakes." Noah indicates Bert Hansen. His father owned fishing boats. "I," says Captain Jones, "freshwater sailing. The sea's another kettle of fish." "I've studied navigation," Noah puts in. "Have you now? And what would be your name, lad?" "Noah Blake." An almost imperceptible glance passes between the captain and the first mate. "And your trade, lad?" "Gunsmith." "Well, now, you wouldn't be Noah Blake's son, would you?" "Yes, sir, I would." Once again the glance flickers between the two men. Then Captain Jones leans back in his chair and looks at the boys with his dead, fishy eyes. "We'll be sailing in 3 days' time. New York, Charleston, Jamaica, Veracruz. 2 months down, more or less, and 2 months back. I pay £10 a month for deck hands." Noah Blake tries to look unimpressed. "This is twice as much as any other captain has offered." "Well, sir, I'll have to discuss it with my father." "To be sure, lad. You can sign the articles tomorrow if you're so minded, all five of you." Noah can hardly wait to tell his father. "I mean, that's good, isn't it?" "Aye, son. Perhaps a little too good. Captain Jones's name is not so white as his ship. He's known as Opium Jones in the trade. He'll be carrying opium, guns, powder, shot, and tools. and he's not too particular who he trades with. Anything wrong with that, father? No. He's no better and no worse than most of the others. Only thing I can't figure out is why he's paying double wages for deckhands. Maybe he'd rather have 5 good hands than 10 waterfront drunks. Maybe. Well, go if you like. But keep your eyes open. The private asshole. The name is Clem Williamson Snide. I am a private asshole. As a private investigator, I run into more death than the law allows. I mean the law of averages. There I am outside the hotel room waiting for the correspondent to reach a crescendo of amorous noises. I always find that if you walk in just as he goes off, he won't have time to disengage himself and take a swing at you. When me and the house dick open the door with a passkey, the smell of shit and bitter almonds blows us back into the hall. Seems they both took a cyanide capsule and fucked until the capsules dissolved. A real messy love death. Another time I am working on a routine case of industrial sabotage when the factory burns down, killing 23 people. These things happen. I am a man of the world. Going to and fro and walking up and down in it. Death smells. I mean, it has a special smell, over and above the smell of cyanide, carrion, blood, cordite, or burnt flesh. It's like opium. Once you smell it, you never forget. I can walk down a street and get a whiff of opium smoke and I know someone is kicking the gong around. I got a whiff of death as soon as Mr. Green walked into my office. You can't always tell whose death it is. Could be Green, his wife, or the missing son he wants me to find. Last letter from the island of Spitzai 2 months ago. After a month with no word, the family made inquiries by long-distance phone. The embassy wasn't at all helpful, said Mr. Green. I nodded. I knew just how unhelpful they could be. They referred us to the Greek police. Fortunately, we found a man there who speaks English. That would be Colonel Dimitri. Yes. You know him. I nodded, waiting for him to continue. He checked and could find no record that Jerry had left the country, and no hotel records after Spitzai. He could be visiting someone. I'm sure he would write. You feel then that this is not just an instance of neglect on his part, or perhaps a lost letter. That happens in the Greek islands. Both Mrs. Green and I are convinced that something is wrong. Very well, Mr. Green, there is the question of my fee, $100 a day plus expenses and $1,000 retainer. If I work on a case 2 days and spend $200, I refund $600 to the client. If I have to leave the country, the retainer is $2,000. Are these terms satisfactory? Yes. Very good. I'll start right here in New York. Sometimes I have been able to provide the client with the missing person's address after a few hours' work. He may have written to a friend. That's easy. He left his address book. Ask me to mail it to him care of American Express in Athens. He passed me the book. Excellent. Now, on a missing person case, I want to know everything the client can tell me about the missing person, no matter how seemingly unimportant and irrelevant. I want to know preferences in food, clothing, colors, reading, entertainment, use of drugs and alcohol, what cigarette brand he smokes, medical history. I have a questionnaire printed with 5 pages of questions. I got it out of the filing cabinet and passed it to him. Will you please fill out this questionnaire and bring it back here day after tomorrow? That will give me time to check out the local addresses. I've called most of them, he said curtly, expecting me to take the next plane for Athens. Of course. But friends of an MP. Missing person are not always honest with the family. Besides, I dare say some of them have moved or had their phones disconnected. Right. He nodded. I put my hands on the questionnaire. Some of these questions may seem irrelevant, but they all add up. I found a missing person once from knowing that he could wriggle his ears. I've noticed that you are left-handed. Is your son also left-handed? Yes, he is. You can skip that question. Do you have a picture of him with you? He handed me a photo. Jerry was a beautiful kid. Slender, red hair, green eyes far apart, a wide mouth. Sexy and kinky looking. Mr. Green, I want all the photos of him you can find. If I use any, I'll have copies made and return the originals. If he did any painting, sketching, or writing, I'd like to see that too. If he sang or played an instrument, I want recordings. In fact, any recordings of his voice. And please bring, if possible, some article of clothing that hasn't been dry cleaned since he wore it. It's true then that you use a psychic methods. I use any methods that help me to find the missing person. If I can locate him in my own mind, that makes it easier to locate him outside it. My wife is into psychic things. That's why I came to you. She has an intuition that something has happened to him, and she says only a psychic can find him. That makes two of us, I thought. He wrote me a check for $1,000. We shook hands. I went right to work. Jim, my assistant, was out of town on an industrial espionage case. He specializes in electronics. So I was on my own. Ordinarily I don't carry iron on an MP case, but this one smelled of danger. I put on my snub-nosed 38, in a shoulder holster. Then I unlocked a drawer and put three joints of the best Colombian, laced with hash, into my pocket. Nothing like a joint to break the ice and stir the memory. I also took a deck of heroin. It buys more than money sometimes. Most of the addresses were in the Soho area. That meant lofts, and that often means the front door is locked. So I started with an address on 6th Street. She opened the door right away, but she kept the chain on. Her pupils were dilated, her eyes running, and she was snuffling, waiting for the man. She looked at me with hatred. I smiled. Expecting someone else. You a cop? No. I'm a private investigator hired by the family to find Jerry Green. You knew him. Look, I don't have to talk to you. No, you don't have to. But you might want to. I showed her the deck of heroin. She undid the chain. The place was filthy, dishes stacked in a sink, cockroaches running over them. The bathtub was in the kitchen and hadn't been used for a long time. I sat down gingerly in a chair with the springs showing. I held the deck in my hand where she could see it. You got any pictures of him? She looked at me and she looked at the heroin. She rummaged in a drawer, and tossed two pictures onto a coffee table that wobbled. Those should be worth something. They were. One showed Jerry in drag, and he made a beautiful girl. The other showed him standing up naked with a hard on. Was he gay? Sure. He liked getting fucked by Puerto Ricans and having his picture took. He pay you? Sure, $20. He kept most of the pictures. Where'd he get the money? I don't know. She was lying. I went into my regular spiel. Now look, I'm not a cop. I'm a private investigator paid by his family. I'm paid to find him, that's all. He's been missing for 2 months. I started to put the heroin back into my pocket and that did it. He was pushing C. I tossed the deck onto the coffee table. She locked the door behind me. Later that evening, over a joint, I interviewed a nice young gay couple, who simply adore Jerry. Such a sweet boy. So understanding. Understanding. About gay people. He even marched with us. And look at the postcard he sent us from Athens. It was a museum postcard showing the statue of a nude youth found at Kouros. Wasn't that cute of him? Very cute, I thought. I interviewed his steady girlfriend, who told me he was all mixed up. He had to get away from his mother's influence and find himself. We talked it over. I interviewed everyone I could find in the address book. I talked to waiters and bartenders all over the Soho area. Jerry was a nice boy, polite, poised, a bit reserved. None of them had an inkling of his double life as a coke pusher and a homosexual transvestite. I see I am going to need some more heroin on this one. That's easy. I know some narco boys who me a favor. It takes an ounce and a ticket to San Francisco to buy some names from the junkie chick. Seek and you shall find. I nearly found an ice pick in my stomach. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. Often it wasn't opened unto me. But I finally found the somebody who, a 20-year-old Puerto Rican kid named Kiki, very handsome and quite fond of Jerry in his way. Psychic too, and into Macambo magic. He told me Jerry had the mark of death on him. What was his source for the coke? His face closed over. I don't know. Can't blame you for not knowing. May I suggest to you that his source was a federal narc? His deadpan went deader. I didn't tell you anything. Did he hear voices? Voices giving him orders. I guess he did. He was controlled by something. I gave him my card. If you ever need anything, let me know. Mr. Green showed up the next morning with a stack of photos. The questionnaire I had given him had been neatly filled out on a typewriter. He also brought a folio of sketches and a green knitted scarf. The scarf reeked of death. I glanced at the questionnaire. Born April 18, 1951, in Little America, Wyoming. Admiral Byrd welcomes you aboard the Deep Freeze Special. I looked through the photos, Jerry as a baby. Jerry on a horse. Jerry with a wide sunlit grin holding up a string of trout, graduation pictures. Jerry as the top in the high school play A Night at the Inn. They all looked exactly as they should look. Like he was playing the part expected of him. There were about 50 recent photos, all looking like Jerry. Take 50 photos of anyone. There will be some photos where the face is so different you can hardly recognize the subject. I mean, most people have many faces. Jerry had one. Don Juan says anyone who always looks like the same person isn't a person. He is a person impersonator. I looked at Jerry's sketches. Good drawing, no talent. Empty and banal as sunlight. There were also a few poems, so bad I couldn't read them. Needless to say, I didn't tell Mr. Green what I had found out about Jerry's sex and drug habits. I just told him that no one I had talked to had heard from Jerry since his disappearance, and that I was ready to leave for Athens at once if he still wanted to retain me. Money changed hands. At the Athens Hilton, I got Dimitri on the phone and told him I was looking for the Green Boy. Ah, yes, we have so many of these cases, our time and resources are limited. I understand. But I've got a bad feeling about this one. He had some kinky habits. SM. Sort of, and underworld connections. I didn't want to mention C over the phone. If I find anything out, I'll let you know. Thanks. I'm going out to Spitzai tomorrow to have a look around. Be back on Thursday. I called Scourers in Spitzai. He's the tourist agent there. He owns or leases villas and rents out apartments during the season. He organizes tours. He owns the discotheque. He is the first man any traveler to Spitzai sees, and the last, since he is also the agent for transport. Yes, I know about it. Had a call from Dimitri. Glad to help any way I can. You need a room. If possible, I'd like the room he had. You can have any room you want, the season is over. For once the hovercraft was working. I was in luck. The hovercraft takes an hour and the boat takes six. Yes, Scourers remember Jerry. Jerry arrived with some young people he'd met on the boat, two Germans with rucksacks and a Swedish girl with English boyfriend. They stayed at one of Scourers' villas on the beach, the end villa, where the road curves out along the sea wall. I knew the place. I'd stayed there once 3 years earlier in 1970. Anything special about the others? Nothing. Looked like thousands of other young people who swarm over the islands every summer. They stayed for a week. The others went on to Lesbos. Jerry went back to Athens alone. Where did they eat? Where did they take coffee? Scour is new. He knows everything that goes on in Spitzai. Go to the discotheque. Every night. The boy Jerry was a good dancer. Anybody in the villa now? Just the caretaker and his wife. He gave me the keys. I noticed a worn copy of The Magus by John Fowles. As soon as anyone walks into his office, Scourers knows whether he should lend him the book. He has his orders. Last time I was there he lent me the book and I read it. Even rode out on a horse to look at the house of the Magus and fell off the horse on the way back. I pointed to the book. By any chance? He smiled. Yes. I lent him the book and he returned it when he left. Said he found it most interesting. Could I borrow it again? Of course. The villa stood 100 feet from the beach. The apartment was on the second floor. 3 bedrooms off a hall, kitchen, and bathroom at the end of the hall, balcony along one side of the building. There was a musty smell, dank and chilly, blinds down. I pulled up the blinds in all 3 bedrooms and selected the middle one, where I had stayed before. 2 beds, 2 chairs, coat hangers on nails in the wall. I switched on an electric heater and took my recorder out of its case. This is a very special recorder designed and assembled by my assistant, Jim, and what it won't pick up isn't there. It is also specially designed for cut-ins and overlays, and you can switch from record to playback without stopping the machine. I recorded a few minutes in all 3 rooms. I recorded the toilet flushing and the shower running. I recorded the water running in the kitchen sink, the rattle of dishes, and the opening and closing and hum of the refrigerator. I recorded on the balcony. Now I lay down on the bed and read some selections from the Magus into the recorder. I will explain exactly how these recordings are made. I want an hour of Spitzai, an hour of places where my MP has been and the sounds he has had. But not in sequence. I don't start at the beginning of the tape and record to the end. I spin the tape back and forth, cutting in at random so that the Magus may be cut off in the middle of a word by a flushing toilet, or the Magus may cut into C sounds. It's a sort of I Ching or table tapping procedure. How random is it actually? Don Juan says that nothing is random to a man of knowledge, everything he sees or hears is there just at that time waiting to be seen and heard. I get out my camera and take pictures of the 3 rooms, the bathroom, and the kitchen. I take pictures from the balcony. I put the machine back in the case and go outside, recording around the villa and taking pictures at the same time, pictures of the villa, a picture of the black cat that belongs to the caretaker, pictures of the beach, which is empty now except for a party of hardy Swedes. I have lunch in a little restaurant on the beach where Jerry and his friends used to eat. Mineral water and a salad. The proprietor remembers me and we shake hands. Coffee at the waterfront cafe where Jerry and his friends took coffee. Record. Take pictures. I cover the post office, the 2 kiosks that sell imported cigarettes and newspapers. The one place I don't record is in Scourers' office. He wouldn't like that. I can hear him loud and clear. I'm a landlord and not a detective. I don't want your MP in my office. He's bad news. I go back to the villa by a different route, covering the bicycle rental agency. It is now 3 o'clock. A time when Jerry would most likely be in his room reading. I read some more of the Magus into the recorder with flushing toilets, running water, my footsteps in the hall, blinds being raised and lowered. I listen to what I have on tape, with special attention to the cut-ins. I take a walk along the seawall and play the tape back to the sea and the wind. Dinner in a restaurant where Jerry and his friends ate the night they arrived. The restaurant is recommended by Scourers. I take my time with several ozos before a dinner of red snapper and Greek salad, washed down with retsina. After dinner I go out to the discotheque to record some of the music Jerry danced to. The scene is really dead. A German countess is dancing with some local youths. Next day there was a wind and the hovercraft was grounded. I took the noon boat and after 6 hours was back in my room at the Hilton. I took out a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Duty Free Scotch and ordered a soda siphon and ice from Hilton Room Service. I put Jerry's graduation picture in a silver frame on the desk, assembled the questionnaire, and put the tape recorder with an hour of Spitzai beside it. The waiter came in with the ice and soda siphon. "Is that your son, sir?" I said yes because it was the easy thing to say. I poured myself a small drink and lit a senior service. I started thinking out loud, cutting into the tape. Suspected to be involved in some capacity, Marty Bloom, a small-time operator with big-time connections, was in Athens at or about the time young Jerry disappeared. Helen and Van also in Athens at the time. Van was trying to get a permit to run a disintoxication clinic on one of the islands. He didn't get it. Left Athens for Tangier. Left Tangier for New York. Trouble at immigration. Thought to be in Toronto. What did I know about these two birds? Plenty. Dr. Van, age 57, nationality, Canadian. Dope pushing and abortion sidelines and front for his real specialty, which is transplant operations. Helen, his assistant, age 60, nationality, Australian. Masseuse, abortionist, suspected jewel thief and murderess. The Countess Minsky Stalenhof de Gulpa, known as many to her friends and sycophants, a heavy woman like a cold fish under tons of gray shale. White Russian and Italian descent. Stratospherically wealthy, near the billion mark. The source of her wealth, manipulation of commodity prices. She moves into a poor country like Morocco and buys up basic commodities like sugar, kerosene, and cooking oil, holds them off the market in her warehouses, then puts them back on the market at a higher price. The Countess has squeezed her vast wealth out of the poorest people. She has other interests than money. She is a very big operator indeed. She owns immense estates in Chile and Peru and has some secret laboratories there. She has employed biochemists and virologists. Indication, genetic experiments and biologic weapons. And what of the Countess de Vile? De Vile, very wealthy but not Gulpa Strata. A depraved, passionate, and capricious woman, evil as Circe. Extensive underworld and police contacts. On close terms with mafia dons and police chiefs in Italy, New York, Morocco, and South America. A frequent visitor at the Countess de Gulpa's South American retreat. Several unsolved missing person cases, involving boys of Jerry's age, point to the South American laboratories as terminal. I glanced through the questionnaire. Medical history, scarlet fever at the age of 4. Now, scarlet fever is a rarity since the introduction of antibiotics. Could there have been a misdiagnosis? All this I was feeding into the recorder in pieces, and a lot more. An article I had just finished reading when Mr. Green came into my office. This was an article on head transplants performed on monkeys, the Sunday Times, December 9, 1973. I now took it out of a file and read parts of it into the recorder. Monkeys' heads transplanted onto monkey bodies can now survive for about a week. The drawing above portrays controversial operation. Technically a human head transplant is possible, Dr. White says, but scientifically there would be no point. My first meeting with Mr. Green, the smell of death, and something shifty about him. From talking to Jerry's friends, I found out that this was a family trait. They all described him as hard to figure or hard to pin down. Finally, I turned on the TV. I played the tape back at low volume while I watched an Italian Western with Greek subtitles, keeping my attention on the screen so I was subconsciously hearing the tape. They were hanging a rustler from horseback when the phone rang. It was Dimitri. "Well, Snide, I think we have found your missing person." "Unfortunately."
"You mean dead?"
"Yes. Embalmed, in fact." He paused. "And without his head."
"What?"
"Yes. Head severed at the shoulders."
"Fingerprints check."
"Yes." I waited for the rest of it. "Cause of death is uncertain.
Some congestion in the lungs. May have been strangulation. The body was found in a trunk.
Who found it?
I did. I happened to be down at the port double-checking the possibility that the boy may have left by freighter, and I saw a trunk being carried aboard a ship with Panamanian registry.
Well, something about the way they were carrying it, the disposition of the weight, you understand.
I had the trunk returned to customs and opened.
The method of embalming, unusual to say the least.
The body was perfectly preserved, but no embalming fluid had been used.
It was also completely nude.
Can I have a look?
Of course.
The Greek doctor had studied at Harvard and he spoke perfect English.
Various internal organs were laid out on a white shelf.
The body, or what was left of it, was in a fetal position.
Considering that this boy has been dead at least a month, the internal organs are in a remarkable state of preservation, said the doctor.
I looked at the body.
Pubic, rectal, and leg hairs were bright red.
However, he was redder than he should have been.
I pointed to some red blotches around the nipples, crotch, thighs, and buttocks.
What's that?
Looks like some kind of rash.
I was wondering about that.
Of course it could have been an allergy.
Redheads are particularly liable to allergic reactions, but he paused.
It looks like scarlet fever.
We are checking all hospitals and private clinics for scarlet fever admissions, Dimitri put in, or any other condition that could produce such a rash.
I turned to the doctor.
Doctor, would you say that the amputation was a professional job?
Definitely.
All questionable doctors and clinics will be checked, said Dimitri.
The preservative seemed to be wearing off, and the body gave off a sweet musky smell that turned me quite sick.
I could see Dimitri was feeling it too, and so was the doctor.
Can I see the trunk?
The trunk was built like an icebox, a layer of cork, and the inside lined with thin steel.
The steel is magnetized, Dimitri told me.
Look.
He took out his car keys and they stuck to the side of the trunk.
Could this have had any preservative effect?
The doctor says no.
Dimitri drove me back to the Hilton.
Well, it looks like your case is closed, Mr. Snide.
I guess so, any chance of keeping this out of the papers?
Yes.
This is not America.
Besides, a thing like this, you understand.
Bad for the tourist business.
Well, yes.
I had a call to make to the next of kin.
Afraid I have some bad news for you, Mr. Green.
Yes.
Well, the boy has been found.
Dead, you mean?
I'm sorry, Mr. Green.
Was he murdered?
What makes you say that?
It's my wife.
She's sort of, well, psychic.
She had a dream.
I see.
Well, yes, it looks like murder.
We're keeping it out of the papers, because publicity would impede the investigation at this point.
I want to retain you again, Mr. Snide.
To find the murderer of my son.
Everything is being done, Mr. Green.
The Greek police are quite efficient.
We have more confidence in you.
I'm returning to New York in a few days.
I'll contact you as soon as I arrive.
The trail was a month old at least.
I was fairly sure the murderer or murderers were no longer in Greece.
No point in staying on.
But there was something else to check out on the way back.
Fever spore.
I stop over in London.
There is somebody I want to see there, if I can find him without too much trouble.
Could save me a side trip to Tangier.
I find him in a gay bar called the Amigo.
He is nattily dressed, with a well-kept beard and shifty eyes.
The Arabs say he has the eyes of a thief.
But he has a rich wife and doesn't need to steal.
Well, he says.
The private eye.
Business or pleasure?
I look around.
Only business would bring me here.
I show him Jerry's picture.
He was in Tangier last summer, I believe.
He looks at the picture.
Sure, I remember him.
A cock teaser.
Missing person case.
Remember who he was with? Some hippie kids. The description sounds like the kids Jerry was with in Spitzai. Props. Did he go anywhere else?
Marrakesh, I think. I am about to finish my drink and leave.
Oh, you remember Peter Winkler who used to run the English pub? Did you know he was dead?
I haven't heard, but I am not much interested.
So? Who or what killed him?
Scarlet fever. I nearly spill my drink.
Look, people don't die of scarlet fever now. In fact, Tihei rarely get it. He was living out on the mountain, the Hamilton summer house. It's quite isolated, you know.
Seems he was alone and the phone was out of order. He tried to walk to the next house down the road and collapsed. They took him to the English hospital. That would finish anyone off. And I suppose Doc Peterson was in attendance.
Made the diagnosis and signed the death certificate.
Who else?
He's the only doctor there.
But what are you so stirred up about?
I never thought you and Winkler were very close.
I cool it.
We weren't. It's just that I started out to be a doctor and I don't like to see a case botched.
I wouldn't say he botched it.
Shot him full of pen strep. Seems he was too far gone to respond.
Yeah.
Pen strep is right for scarlet fever. He must have been practically dead on arrival.
Oh, not quite. He was in the hospital about 24 hours.
I don't say any more.
I've said too much already.
Looks like I'll have to make that side trip to Tangier. I checked into the Rembrandt and took a taxi to the Martian. It was 3 p.m. when I rang the doctor's bell. He was a long time coming to the door, and was not pleased to see me.
I'm sorry to disturb you during the siesta hour, doctor, but I'm only in town for a short stay and it's rather important.
He was not altogether mollified, but he led me into his office.
Dr. Peterson, I have been retained by the heirs of Peter Winkler to investigate the circumstances of his death. The fact that he was found unconscious by the side of a road has led them to speculate that there might be some question of accidental death. That would mean double indemnity on the insurance.
No question whatsoever.
There wasn't a mark on him except for the rash, that is.
Well, his pockets were turned inside out, but what do you expect in a place like this?
You're quite sure that he died of scarlet fever?
Quite sure.
A classical case.
I think that the fever may have caused brain damage and that is why he didn't respond to antibiotics.
Cerebral hemorrhage may have been a contributory case.
There was bleeding.
Yes, from the nose and mouth.
And this couldn't have been a concussion.
Absolutely no sign of concussion.
Was he delirious at any time?
Yes.
For some hours.
Did he say anything?
Anything that might indicate he had been attacked.
It was gibberish in some foreign language.
I administered morphine to quiet him.
I'm sure you did the right thing, doctor, and I will report to his heirs that there is nothing to support a claim of accidental death.
That is your considered opinion.
It is.
He died of scarlet fever and slash or complications attendant on scarlet fever.
I thanked him and left.
I had some more questions, but I was sure he couldn't or wouldn't answer them.
I went back to the hotel and did some work on the recorder.
At 7 o'clock I walked over to the English pub. There was a young Arab behind the bar whom I recognized as one of Peter's boyfriends. Evidently he had inherited the business.
I showed him Jerry's picture.
Oh yes.
Mr. Jerry.
Peter like him very much.
Give him free drinks.
He never make out though.
Boy just lead him on.
I asked about Peter's death.
Very sad.
Peter alone in house.
Tell me he want to rest few days.
Did he seem sick?
Not sick.
He just looked tired.
Mr. Jerry gone to Marrakesh and I think Peter a little sad.
I could have checked hospitals in Marrakesh for scarlet fever cases, but I knew already what I needed to know.
I knew why Peter hadn't responded to antibiotics.
He didn't have scarlet fever. He had a virus infection. The stranger. The next day the five boys signed on with the Great White and moved into the forecastle. Three youths were already there. They introduced themselves as Bill, Guy, and Adam. Noah noticed that they all had the same pale faces and fish eyes as Captain Jones. The forecastle was clean and newly painted, with a faint hospital smell of carbolic. An impish red-haired boy of about 15 brings mugs of tea on a tray. "I'm Jerry, the cabin boy. Anything you want, just let me know. It's a pleasure to serve you, gentlemen." Bill, Guy, and Adam washed down black pellets with the tea. "What's that?" Brady asks. "Oh, just something to keep out the cold. The boys are kept busy loading cargo supplies." Mr. Thomas gives instructions in a quiet voice. He seems easygoing and good-natured. But his eyes make Noah uneasy. They are cold as winter ice. Pages from Noah Blake's diary. Tuesday, February 5th, 1702, today we sailed. Despite Captain Jones's slighting remarks about freshwater sailing, our experience on the lake stands us in good stead. I notice that Guy, Bill, and Adam, though they are very thin and pale and sick-looking, are good seamen and seem immune to cold and fatigue. An hour before sailing, a carriage pulled up at the wharf and two people got out and came on board. I could not see them clearly, for they were wearing furs with hoods, but I could tell that they were young and looked much alike. When the ship was clear of the harbor and on course, the cabin boy brought tea. Two passengers on board, he told us. "Have you seen them?" I carried their luggage to the cabin. "And what are they like?" "More like leprechauns than humans. Green they are, green as shamrock." "Green?" With smooth greenish faces. "Twins, one a boy and one a girl. And rich too. You can smell the money off them." February 6th, 1702, neither the two passengers nor the captain has appeared on deck. Bert Hansen and myself have been given turns at the wheel. The food is good and plentiful and I have talked with the cook. His name is Charlie Lee. He is about 20 years old, half black and half Chinese. I'm thinking there is something between him and the cabin boy. We will dock in New York tomorrow. February 7th, 1702, too late to dock. We are riding at anchor. There is naught to be done, and after the evening meal we had a talk with Guy, Adam, and Bill. I have found out what it is that they take with their tea night and morning, opium. They have enough to last them the voyage. "And should we need more, we have but to ask the captain," said Guy. "Sure, and he should be made of the stuff," Sean Brady put in. Seeing his name is Opium Jones. It seems they have shipped with Captain Jones before. He pays double because he only wants certain type people on his ship. And what type would that be? Them as do the work, mind their own business, and keep their mouths shut to outsiders. February 8th, 1702, today we docked in New York. Captain Jones appeared on deck and guided the ship into the harbor. I will say for him he knows his business when he chooses to mind it. A carriage was waiting at the pier and the two passengers got in and were driven away. We were kept busy most of the day loading and unloading cargo under the supervision of Mr. Thomas. Captain Jones went ashore on business of some kind. In the late afternoon we were allowed ashore. There is more bustle here than in Boston and more ships, of course. We were immediately set upon by Pandarus extolling the beauty and sound condition of their whores. When we told them to be off and fuck their wares they showered us with insults from a safe distance. I have a letter to the Pembertons, the parents of my stepmother, and father impressed on me the importance of paying my respects and instructed me in how to conduct myself. It seems that the Pemberton family is well known here, and I had no trouble finding the house, which is of red brick and very imposing, with four stories. I rang the bell and a servant came to the door and asked my business in somewhat peremptory tones. I presented him with the letter. He told me to wait and went inside. When he returned a few minutes later, his manner was quite respectful. He told me that Mr. Pemberton would be happy to entertain me for dinner the following night at 8 o'clock. February 9, 1702, this night I had dinner with the Pembertons. Arriving a few minutes early, I walked up and down until the chimes sounded 8. My father had admonished me always to be punctual for appointments and never under any circumstances to be early. The servant showed me into an ornately furnished room with portraits and a marble fireplace. Mr. Pemberton greeted me most politely. He is a trim, smallish man with white hair and twinkling blue eyes. He then presented me to his wife, who extended a hand without getting up, smiling as though it hurt her to do so. I took an immediate dislike to her, which I am sure was reciprocated. The other people present, I soon realized, were none other than the passengers on board the Great White, two of the strangest and most beautiful people I have ever seen. They are twins, one a boy, the other a girl about 20 years old. They have greenish complexions, straight black hair, and jet black eyes. Both possess such ease and grace of manner that I was quite dazzled. The names I believe are Juan and Maria Cocuera de Fuentes. When I shook hands with the boy, a tremor passed through me and I was glad of the diversion when Mr. Pemberton offered me a glass of sherry. While we were having the sherry, a Mr. Vermeer was announced. He is as portly as Mr. Pemberton is trim, and gives a great impression of wealth and power. Shortly thereafter, dinner was served. Mr. Pemberton took the head of the table, with Mr. Vermeer on his right and Maria de Fuentes on his left. I was seated opposite Juan de Fuentes, with Mrs. Pemberton on my right, though I would gladly have been as far away from her as possible. The de Fuentes twins had come from Mexico and were on their way to Veracruz. The talk was mostly about business, trade, mining, and the produce of Mexico. Maria spoke in her cool, clear voice. Crops now grown only in the Middle and Far East could be introduced, since the soil and climate is suitable. I noted that the Pembertons and Mr. Vermeer defer to the twins and listen respectfully to their opinions. Several times Mr. Pemberton addressed a question to me, and I answered briefly and politely, as my father had instructed me. When I told him I planned to be a sea captain, he looked a little vague and distracted and said that the sea was a good thing for a young man. To be sure, a master's certificate would do no harm. However, the opportunities in the family business were not to be overlooked. Mr. Vermeer expressed concern with regard to the political instability of Mexico. Maria de Fuentes replied that the introduction of suitable crops would undoubtedly produce a tranquilizing and stabilizing effect. She has a way of underscoring certain words with special import. Mr. Vermeer nodded and said, "Ah, yes, sound economy brings sound politics." I had a feeling that the talk would have been more open if I had not been present. Why then, I asked myself, had I been invited? The words of my father came back to me, "In the course of any meeting, try to discover what it is that is wanted from you." While I could not decide what it was, I knew that something very definite was wanted and expected from me. I surmised further that Mrs. Pemberton was less convinced of my potential usefulness than her husband, and that she considered my presence at the dinner table a hindrance and a waste of time. At one point Juan de Fuentes looked straight into my eyes, and once again I felt a tremor run through me and for a second had a most curious impression that we were alone at the table. After dinner, I excused myself to return to the ship since we will be sailing before noon. February 10, 1702, the twins arrived shortly before sailing. Captain Jones took the wheel on leaving the harbor. "We are heading south with a good wind. Weather very damp and cold." February 11, 1702, this morning I awoke with a sore throat, my head throbbing and feverish, and a congestion in my lungs, feeling barely able to rise from my bunk. Adam smiled and told me that the remedy was to hand. He carefully measured out 6 drops of opium tincture and I downed it with hot tea. In a few minutes a feeling of warmth and comfort spread from the back of my neck through my body. The soreness in my throat and the aching in my head disappeared as if by magic. I have been able to take my watch without difficulty. When I came into sleep, the dose was repeated. There is an extraordinary clarity in my thoughts. I am unable to sleep. Writing this by candle. I am asking myself where I came from, how I got here, and who I am. From earliest memory I have felt myself a stranger in the village of Harbor Point where I was born. Who was I? I remember morning doves calling from the woods in summer dawn, and the long cold shut in winters. Who was I? The stranger was footsteps in the snow a long time ago. And who are the others? Brady, Hansen, Paco, Todd. Strangers like myself. I think that we came from another world and have been stranded here like mariners on some barren and hostile shore. I never felt that what we did together was wrong, but I fully understood the necessity and wisdom of concealing it from the villagers. Now that there is no need for concealment, I feel as if this ship is the home I had left and thought never to find again. But the voyage will end, of course, and what then? I know that my father will shortly be a wealthy man and that I could become, in course of time, wealthy myself. The prospect holds little appeal. Of what use is wealth if I must conform to customs that are as meaningless to me as they are obstructive of my true inclination and desires? I am minded to seek my fortunes in the Red Sea or in South America. Perhaps I could find employment with the De Fuentes family. Now the face of Juan drifts before my eyes, and divorced by the effects of opium from the urgings and priclings of lust, I can examine the vision dispassionately. I feel not only attraction but kinship. He too is a stranger, but he moves with ease and confidence among the terrestrials. Shore leave. February 12, 1702, for some reason we will not dock at Charleston as planned. The weather is milder each day. The De Fuentes twins now walk about the deck familiarizing themselves with all the workings and parts of the ship. Everything they do or say seems to have some hidden purpose. Juan has asked me many questions relative to my trade as a gunsmith. Would it be possible to shoot arrows from a gun? I replied that it would, and suddenly saw a picture of Indians attacking a settlement with arrows tipped with burning pitch. I cannot recall where I saw this picture before, probably in Boston. As the picture flashed through my mind, Juan nodded and smiled and walked away. His twin sister has the manner and directness of a man, with none of the coy enticing ways usually found in her sex. In any case, female blandishments would here fall on barren soil. Yet I must confess myself more attracted to her than to any woman I have yet seen. February 13, 1702, good winds and fair weather continue. We no longer need our great coats. February 14, 1702, we are now off the coast of Florida and seldom out of sight of land since there are many islands. Dolphins leap about the prow and flying fish scatter before us in silver showers. We are now able to work without shirts, but Mr. Thomas has cautioned us to be careful of sunburn and to expose ourselves only for minutes at a time. Captain Jones appears on deck, scanning the horizon through his telescope. I think he plans to put in at one of the islands for fresh water and provisions. February 15, 1702, Mr. Thomas's warning, both Bird and myself have painful sunburns from the waist up, owing to our fair complexions, whereas Clinch, Sean, and Paco are unaffected. Bill, Guy, and Adam never take their shirts off. Charlie Lee, the cook, has some skill as physician though without formal training. He has given us an ointment to rub on our bodies, which has afforded considerable relief, and we have both taken some drops of opium tincture. Adam has given me a small bottle and showed me how to measure out the correct dose. He tells me the amount he takes would make us deathly sick and could be lethal. February 16, 1702, I am now recovered from the sunburn and my body is beginning to acquire a protective tan. This morning we all gathered at the rail to witness a great commotion in the water a few hundred yards ahead, occasioned by mackerel leaping to escape larger fish. Mr. Thomas gave the order to lower sail and issued fishing poles with spoons and triple hooks. In a short time a number of great fish were flapping on the deck. These fish are known as yellowtails and are highly esteemed for the table. We were kept busy cleaning the fish, at which of course we are adept from our experience on the Great Lakes. Some were reserved for immediate use and the others salted and laid away. After the blood was washed from the decks, we hoisted sail and proceeded on our way. The fresh fish has provided a most welcome change from a diet of salt cod and cornmeal, although the flavor is not as delicate as fish from fresh water. February 18, 1702, dreamed this morning I was in a large workshop with tools, a forge, and gun parts scattered on a bench. I was examining a gun with a number of barrels welded together. I was trying to arrive at a method of firing the barrels in sequence. One was standing to one side and behind me. He pointed to an iron wheel with a handle and said something I did not catch because at this moment Clinch Todd came off his watch and awakened me, grumbling that we had ejaculated all over his blankets. The wind has fallen and we are moving now at a few knots an hour. Asterisk. February 19, 2021, 1702, we are almost becalmed and take advantage of the slow movement to fish from the deck. I hooked a shark and the pole was torn from my hands and lost. We seem to float on a sea of glass, like a painted ship. Tempers are short. Brady and Mr. Thomas got into an altercation and I thought they would come to blows. February 22, 1702, today we put ashore on an uninhabited island to take on water and what provisions we could find. Captain Jones had spotted a stream through his telescope. We anchored in a bay between two points of land about 200 yards from a beach with coconut palms behind it. The water here is so clear that you can see fish at a considerable depth. We are sure at least to find abundant coconuts. Mr. Thomas, Bert Hansen, Clinch Todd, Paco, Jerry the cabin boy and myself put ashore in a boat loaded with water kegs. We filled the kegs with fresh water and loaded them into the boat. Todd and Paco rowed back to the ship and returned with empty kegs. When sufficient water had been collected, we filled the boat a number of times with coconuts. It was now afternoon. Mr. Thomas then gave us the rest of the day off to explore the island, admonishing us to be back on the beach before sundown. Before returning to the ship, he issued to each of us a cutlass for the unlikely event we should encounter dangerous animals or hidden natives. Following the stream, we climbed to the summit of the island, a distance of about 600 feet. From the summit, we had a fine view of the whole island. The great white appeared at that distance like a toy. On the far side of the island are a number of small bays and inlets, and we made our way down to a little beach surrounded on both sides by overhanging rocks. Here we stripped off our clothes and swam in the bay for half an hour, being careful not to venture too far out for fear of sharks. The water is wonderfully warm and buoyant, quite unlike the swimming in freshwater lakes. Feeling hunger after our swim, we put out lines which we had brought and soon took a number of the fish known as red snapper, each one 2 or 3 pounds in weight. 5 fish we fried in a pan, leaving the others on a string through the gills in the water. This most delectable fish we ate with our fingers, washing the meat down with coconut milk. Feeling a great drowsiness after eating, we all lay down naked in the shade of a rock, Jerry with his head on my stomach and I in turn resting my head on Bert Hansen's stomach. Clinch and Paco lay on their backs, side by side, with an arm around the other's shoulders. The heat, our full stomachs, and the sound of gently lapping waves put us into a light sleep which lasted for about an hour. I woke with a strong erection and found my companions in the same condition. We stood up stretching and comparing. The breeze was rising and it was getting towards sundown. We put out our lines and caught enough fish to make a good string, and made our way back to the beach as speedily as possible. Jerry kept us all laughing, slashing with his cutlass at trees and branches with fierce snarls and pirate cries. Adam and Bill rowed ashore and took us back to the ship. Sail was raised and we got underway. While we were gone, a number of different fish had been taken from the ship, and for supper we had a spicy fish stew with grated coconut. A shout from Jerry while we're eating brought us all to the rail, where we witnessed a wondrous sight known as the green flash, which occurs a moment after sunset. The whole western sky lit up a brilliant luminous green. Lettre de Marque. February 28, 1702, today we were captured by pirates. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon a heavily armed ship came abreast of us flying the Dutch flag, which was then lowered and the black pirate flag raised. We were carrying no cannon, so resistance was out of the question and Captain Jones immediately gave the order to raise the flag of truce. We all gathered on deck, including the De Fuentes twins,